I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking with the editor of a new book and the director of an organization, Project Censored, which has been in business for 30 years, chronicling the stories that are overlooked or misreported in the news media in the United States, talking about their new volume, the contents of it, and the problems of journalism in the United States today. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
In a stark moment of wag-the-doggery, journalists got to witness and record the rehearsal of an October 13th presidential teleconference with troops stationed in Iraq. The event was billed by the White House as authentic dialogue, but the pre-show coaching from Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Allison Barber doesn't match up.
The president's going to ask some questions, and he may ask all six of them. He may ask three of them. So what we want to be prepared for is to not stutter. So if there's a question that the president comes up with that we haven't drilled through today, then I'm expecting the microphone to go right back to you, Captain Kennedy, and you to handle.
Okay.
If all else fails, start singing.
Further diggings discovered at least one of the 11 soldiers handpicked to participate in the teleconference is a military PR flak on active duty. Another has an impressive record of giving out positive quotes about the Iraq occupation. Most of the fallout over the fake presidential conversation, however, has landed on Ed Schultz. He is a progressive talk show host out of North Dakota whose program was to begin airing on the Armed Forces Radio Network on October 17th. But the day after the staged teleconference, Schultz openly criticized the charade. That's when he got a call from the Pentagon telling him they'd changed their mind and had no plans to carry his program on military media for the foreseeable future. In related news, on October 20th, the Commerce Committee of the U.S. Senate unanimously approved the Truth in Broadcasting Act, which requires the clear labeling of government-produced video and audio news releases. Senator Frank Lautenberg, a Democrat from New Jersey, is the sponsor of the bill.
Fake television news stories that conceal the government's role have no place in our democracy, and it is not and should not be a partisan issue.
The Commerce Committee did amend the bill slightly, though, to exempt media produced by intelligence services like the CIA from mandatory disclosure. Elsewhere on the propaganda front, the U.S. Department of Education has turned over information to federal prosecutors relating to its $250,000 PR contract with conservative commentator Armstrong Williams, for which he wrote columns and made TV appearances pushing administration education policies. No word on whether fraud charges are forthcoming. For his part, Williams says he's already negotiating terms under which he will pay back part of his payment.
The city of San Francisco has put out a call for proposals to build a citywide Wi-Fi network. It received a record amount of response, more than 24 bids, including one from Google, which proposes to offer access to its network for free. But that doesn't mean users won't pay in other respects. The search giant is already running a prototype Wi-Fi hotspot downtown, which uses special technology to track the location of those logged on in order to serve up custom location-specific advertising. Additionally, Google plans to cap the speed of free access to just a fraction of what's available over a typical DSL or cable modem. If users want more bandwidth, they'll have to pay for it. Other companies have also proposed providing minimal access to the network for free, but would charge around $20 per month for a broadband-level advertising-free connection.
Back in August, we told you about a power shift in the structure of News Corporation, which gave Fox News cable channel founder and Republican strategist Roger Ailes a measure of control over the company's 36 TV stations. Since then, the news staffs at these Fox stations flew to New York for intensive training on how to adopt the language and perspective of the Fox News channel. In addition to making sure everyone's working out of the same journalistic playbook, Fox plans to create an evening newscast to compete with ABC, CBS, and NBC, and is also working up longer-form infotainment shows based around Fox News Channel personalities.
The squeeze is on in the newspaper business. Major metropolitan dailies have announced a slew of layoffs over the course of the year. Hundreds of newsroom personnel have been let go. The cuts are blamed in part on the rising cost of newsprint, which is forcing several major papers, including the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, to literally shrink in size. The Wall Street Journal's cutting 3 inches, an entire column's worth of newsprint, off its editions. The Times plans to trim an inch. And the Gannett Company, publisher of 99 newspapers, including USA Today, has announced it will shrink its pages too, but hasn't said by how much. It's estimated that these moves will lower the amount of actual news content in the affected papers by 5 to 10%. However, none of this means that newspapers aren't still quite profitable. According to industry analysis, on average, U.S. newspapers make about 20% more money than they take to print.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're the radio station hosted by the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we come right out of Campbell Hall, serving you every Sunday afternoon, and it's a pleasure to be here again this week. This week, we've got a terrific guest for you, Peter Phillips, the professor of sociology and the director of Project Censored, is here to talk about the new volume of Project Censored's book, Media Democracy in Action, Censored 2006, just published in September by Seven Stories Press. Peter, we're talking to you out in Sonoma, California, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to the airwaves today. Thank you for joining us.
Well, Bob, thanks for having me on. It's great to be speaking with you. I consider you one of the leaders in media reform today, so it's an important interview. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I think for some of our listeners might not be familiar with Project Censored. I know many of them probably are. But why don't you just give a little bit of the history of Project Censored, how long you guys have been around, what it's been up to, and what you do?
Well, we make an annual list of the most important news stories that the corporate media hasn't covered. And there's over 200 of us at Sonoma State University, faculty and students, about 100 students, researching stories year-round and narrowing it from thousands down to hundreds down to 25 that are deemed the most important but have had literally zero coverage in the corporate media in the U.S. This is our 29th year. This book is the 29th list, so we're actually on our 30th year of operation doing this.
Literally zero or almost zero.
Almost zero.
Yeah, because literally it's awfully hard to enforce. There must be someone like...
Oh, no. Well, I mean, you may have a story that ran on page, you know, A17 one time in the New York Times or something like that, but then got nothing after that. That's a really important story. So we'll go ahead and give it more attention.
You know, now most Americans, and I think this is probably even more true when Project Censored was launched in the 1970s, when they hear a term censored, you think about Darkness at Noon, about some government commissar coming in and arresting an editor or spiking a story. But that's not the sort of censored that Project Censored is dealing with in our news media, is it?
No, we have a broad definition of censorship, and that's any interference with the free flow of information in society. And that's generally structural in how the media is organized and the fact that they're in the entertainment business. So we get massive coverage on things like the Peterson murder case or the Michael Jackson trial, which all have opportunity costs for covering other stories. And then we see that the U.S. media is really in the entertainment business and has somewhat abdicated their responsibility to the First Amendment to keep an informed electorate aware of what the powerful are doing.
But, I mean, these companies will defend themselves, so people are much more interested in hearing about whether Cato Kaelin can get a job or get a girlfriend or Lacey Peterson or whether Winona Ryder, you know, have a facelift, than they are knowing about, you know, toxic dumps or world trade issues. And, you know, their job is to give the people what they want. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's certainly the excuse that media will say. We're just giving the people what they want. But, you know, in reality, I mean, people all over the country want to know what's affecting their lives. They want to know why health care isn't available for 40 million Americans, or why wages for working people have not advanced in the last 25 years and declined for most. And, you know, it's entertaining to see a juicy murder trial. It's entertaining to know about the sex lives of stars. And so when that's on, it's almost addictive. It gives you something to gossip about and that. But it's really unimportant to most people. And they just kind of turn away from it, or we end up with a lot of cynicism in society. And people really do want to know what the powerful are doing, and the media is simply not telling us that.
We're talking to Peter Phillips today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Peter Phillips is a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University, and for our purposes, most importantly, he is the director of Project Censored and the editor of the new book, Censored 2006, just published by Project Censored, just published by Seven Stories Press, of the 25, chronicling the 25 most censored stories in the U.S. news media in 2005. This is a very impressive book, 430 pages long, tremendous detail. A sizable industrial undertaking in its own right. And Project Censored has been doing this now for 30 years. What did the book look like 20 years ago? I mean, has it always been this beefy, or is this thing growing?
Well, actually, it's the fattest book we've ever done.
Yeah, it's like a Brooklyn phone book or something.
Yeah. It's Carl Jensen, when he started the project back in 1976, really just did a press release. And the students would come up with a list of stories, and then he had the national judges rank them, and then they'd put it out as a press release. So it was only about 15 years ago that we actually started coming out with a book. And so we've had a volume, a book, ever since. And they've gotten bigger. I sort of think we've reached that point where we don't want to make it any bigger than it is. In fact, maybe even slim it down some next year and focus on the stories. But there's a huge amount of content in the book around the Iraq War, around election fraud, around 9/11, stories that just continue to be left out of the corporate media.
Yeah, it's a very impressive book, and I urge listeners who are interested in this issue to see it. I think, to put it in historical context, when Project Censored first began with Carl Jensen, and before you got involved, Peter, roughly a decade ago, just the idea that there was censored news, I think, was jarring for most people in our society. The name was arresting, because we don't think of our news media as having any censorship. Has that changed? Do you think, is the name still jar people?
It does somewhat, because I think, people inside of corporate media know that there's problems with getting stories out, and there's certain things that their career won't advance if they cover or focus on. But they don't think of it as overt censorship, which the word implies, censor from the Latin, that was somebody in the Roman government that, controlled news, controlled what was going out. So we have some of that. We certainly have that in war zones, and we certainly have some of that in terms of controlling information through public relations firms and PR people that work for government and corporations. But most journalists like to think that they can go after a story and publish it if they want to, and most of them want to do Watergate stories and that sort of thing. But increasingly, their careers are on the line, and the book this year is dedicated to Gary Webb, whose career was on the line for challenging the CIA and their involvement with drug dealing and the Contras in the 80s.
Yeah, let me stop you there if I can, Peter Phillips, because I wanted to ask you about that. The book is dedicated to the late Gary Webb. And before we go through the stories and talk any more about the book and the winners, if they can use that term, of the top 25 list this year of most censored stories, just give a little background for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with Gary Webb, what he did and why he dedicated the book to him.
Well, in 1996, Gary, through the San Jose Mercury News, 96 and 97, did a series of articles that documented how the CIA was fully aware that the Contra organization, which was at that time doing guerrilla warfare in Nicaragua, was selling cocaine in California, in both the Bay Area and in Los Angeles, in large quantities, tons of cocaine, and that the profits were going back to support the Contras. And the CIA not only was aware of it, but in some cases, pretty clear, it helped facilitate the movement of the drugs. Now, this had been investigated early on in the late 80s by the Kerry Commission and had been reported on, but got very little coverage in the media. And Gary went in and got records, and he interviewed pilots, and he documented everything, and it was on the front page of the Mercury, San Jose Mercury News. No one else in the country touched it. It was almost like it was going to be ignored until Maxine Waters and the Black Caucus started having hearings about it in Congress. When that starts to happen, then the Washington Post at least starts to, well, okay, people in Congress are talking about it. We better look into this and investigate it. And they literally put their attack dogs on trying to take the story apart. So Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, New York Times were all wrote critical articles of the story. So for most people in the country, they saw a CIA denial or a critical article of the story before they even had a chance to read Gary Webb's work or look at the documentation. The Mercury News backed him for about 6 months, and then Jerry Sipos, the editor there, pulled him off the under pressure, pulled him off the case, and reassigned him to 100 miles from his home to cover Little League games, and pulled him off out of Sacramento, where he was a political reporter for 20 years, and his career was over. I mean, he realized he ultimately resigned his position and went to work with the state legislature in California, did investigative work and writing there for a number of years, and lost his job last year, and his marriage broke up, and he was and he committed suicide.
Yeah, it's an absolutely tragic story. And just for the sake of closure on that, how does Gary Webb's story stand up? I mean, it came under severe attack from the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times. Now that the dust is cleared, so to speak.
LA Times couldn't even leave him alone after his death and said how he had been debunked. And it's just absolutely not true. The CIA 3 years later admitted that they were aware the Contras were dealing drugs, but they had a deal with the Justice Department that they didn't have to report that for national security reasons. And his book, Dark Alliance, which was published through Seven Stories Press, did further documentation. And anybody that sits down and reads that book, you become absolutely convinced that he was completely right on the issues.
We're talking to Peter Phillips today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Peter Phillips is the director of Project Censored, based out of Sonoma State University, where he's also a professor of sociology. Project Censored is a group almost 30 years old that provides an annual review of the news that didn't make the news, the top 25 stories every year that the U.S. news media have not covered at all or barely at all of what should be a great importance in the view of Project Censored, and you can be the judge yourself of the quality of their list. The book is available now, the Censored 2006, which includes the 25 winners, so to speak, the top 25 censored stories of 2005. It's available thanks to Seven Stories Press, just came out, and got a stunning review by Molly Ivins in the Chicago Tribune in her syndicated column a few weeks ago. So people interested in these issues, it's a book well worth taking a look at. I should remind you, listeners, that this program has been pre-recorded. We taped it a few weeks before going on air because I'm on assignment this weekend. And so don't call in today. Sit back, relax, enjoy the show, and listen to Peter Phillips and yours truly do the yakking for today. Peter, let's go through the list a little bit and see what the grand winners are of the top 25 most censored stories of 2005 in the U.S. news media. And I guess even before we go to this list, I don't keep stalling here, but how do you... I mean, I go down this list, and I'm looking at, like, number, 23 or 4 on Palestinian children or Ethiopian victims of, or Homeland Security, number 25, Designed to Fail. And I wonder, how do you pick number 1 over number 25? How do you rank order stories, which, from my naked view, all look very important?
Well, it's hard to... the national judges and... Robin Anderson at Department of Communications at Fordham, Leanne Casson at Chicago Media Watch, Lenore Forestell from Mutual Facilitator for Progressive International Media Exchange, Mark Crispin Miller, Michael Parenti. There's 25 national judges, of which you were one for a few years and helped us greatly, and you actually rank the stories. I mean, so we send 25 stories to these national judges, and they in turn vote, and the ones that get the most votes are ranked in that way. So it's a subjective process, but the reviews that have gone into the stories before they even get to the national judges are extensive.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of hours of research.
No, I can vouch for that from my experience as a judge. Well, let's get right to the, I guess we should start at the top, not keep people in suspense, because that's a cruel thing to do. Number one, Bush administration moves to eliminate open government. The top story. Now, that's, yeah, what is that story, and why wasn't it in the news, and why should it be?
Well, we don't always know why it wasn't in the news, but we originally saw this on Common Dreams.
The website.
It's a website, commondreams.org, with commentators on a daily basis, and Henry Waxman is a Democrat in the House of Representatives from Chicago. He did an 81-page...
No, for California.
California. He did a 81-page report that found the federal government had consistently narrowed the scope and application of the Freedom of Information Act and the Presidential Records Act. So Freedom of Information gives citizens the ability to file a request for specific information from a government agency and provides recourse in federal court if the agency fails to comply. But over the last two decades, beginning with Reagan and really accelerated under the current Bush administration, agencies have made extensive and arbitrary use of FOIA exemptions, such as classified information or attorney-client documents. And the Bush administration has openly refused to release records to congressional subcommittees, the Government Accountability Office, and in particular, like the Cheney Energy Task Force documents. They've actually gone to court and defended their right to keep those secret.
So that's number one. I guess that is sort of important if you don't have an open government and the ability to monitor what people in power are doing. Do you think a story like this would have existed 20 years ago? I mean, is this the sort of story that once would have been news that no longer is, or is this sort of, or did this not exist 10 years ago? You know, what's your sense historically of how this story fits into things?
Well, when Project Censored started, there were 50 major media corporations in the country. And a story like this would have a better chance then of getting into some of them, and it'd be more of a competitive story that would get put out there. The 10 big media corporations today are literally interlocked in terms of boards of directors, and often are sharing the same sources of news and looking for stories with a official response. So they're coming from the White House, the Pentagon, or big corporations. So this is not something that fits into the general framework of the news that's being presented by corporate media today. That government is becoming less open and is covering up what's going on inside.
Also, I mean, it's hard to do a comparison simply because this is about something the Bush administration is doing. And since they weren't in power 15 years ago, it wasn't going on. You can't really compare it to anything 15 years ago necessarily. You know, I should also point out that when you talk about the most censored stories, they're all based on some sort of alternative press coverage. Is that right? So there's someone who did cover this. It just didn't get covered widely.
It was covered in the report came out. So it was it's on a website for the Democrats and Reform Government story online, and then it came out in Common Dreams as a shorter op-ed piece about it, and that was it. I mean, it didn't make press in terms of the New York Times. You know, Congressman Henry Waxman files a report saying that there's been a decline in access to information of government activities.
You know what's interesting about this, Peter Phillips, is that this is a story, these moves to end the ability to use Freedom of Information Act to find out what's going on in the government. It's interesting at two levels for me. First of all, conservatives, of which the Bush administration claimed to be, traditionally were very concerned about hyper-powerful government that was unaccountable. I mean, that was always their critique of the federal government, and that therefore accountability of government was crucial if you wanted to rein it in. And secondly, as for the media, as far as they're concerned, you know, they're the ones who lose out when you don't have open government. Their ability to cover public life and government is compromised, if not terminated, if they don't have access to what the government's doing.
Exactly.
So why aren't they raising hell on an issue like this?
What the corporate media has literally become dependent upon the State Department, the White House, the Pentagon, as a source of news. to be raising issues about FOIA issues. Any records having to do with weapons of mass destruction or any information that could be misused to harm the security of the nation is now exempt under FOIA requests. So the message to corporate media is don't go after information that will embarrass the government. And they're complying. They're just not doing it.
We're talking to Peter Phillips today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a couple weeks before going on air. So please don't call in with any questions today. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Next week, we'll be back live. And at that time, I will have the final complete rundown on how we did in the pledge drive last week. And I'm taping this before the pledge drive, so I'm hoping I'll be announcing that we'll have gangbusters a jackpot record to announce. But we'll see. Whatever it is a week from today, I'll share the news, good or bad, or it won't be bad, but how good, with you all. Today, though, we'll sit back, relax, and enjoy the program with Peter Phillips, the director of Project Censored and the editor of the new book, Censored 2006, the top 25 censored stories in the U.S. news media in 2005. We've just been talking about the first one, the Bush administration moves to eliminate open government. You referred to national security, the war on terrorism in your answer to number one, and I see that number two on the list is media coverage fails on Iraq, Fallujah, and the civilian death toll. And, there's other Iraq stories on the list and other foreign policy stories. So, I mean, that. What do you talk about that one?
Well, Les Roberts he's an investigator at John Hopkins School of Public Health. He conducted a rigorous inquiry in Iraq on pre- and post-invasion mortality rates among Iraqi families. And this was done in cooperation with university students in Baghdad that spread out around the country. And this report was published in Lancet Medical Journal in Great Britain a year ago. And it, at that time, said that there had been an increase of civilian casualties, of civilian deaths, by at minimum of 100,000 people, mostly women and children, and who had been mostly killed by aerial bombing and rockets. So this isn't our troops on the ground going in and killing people extensively. But aerial bombing, in almost all cases, was the main 95% of the deaths were caused by gunship rockets and aerial weaponry. So this is in a Lancet Medical Journal. It gets in the papers all over Europe. And it gets minor coverage here, is dismissed by the Pentagon as an invalid study, and then just disappears. So that's one part of it. And this was before the invasion of Fallujah, mm-hmm. where Fallujah was a city of 300,000 residents, and the people were told they had to get out. So we invaded once, and we got shot up really bad. So we backed off and said, okay, we're coming back in again. And so these 300,000 people are fleeing with really nowhere to go. They're out in fields, vacant lots, abandoned buildings, no shelter, and care. But 50,000 are either can't get out or are trapped by coalition forces in there. And men between ages of 15 and 45 were not allowed safe passage. So the people that remained in the city, it became a free fire zone. The water and electricity was cut off. The main hospital was seized. Anyone who ventured out was shot at. So there were reports even of families that were fleeing with white flags were shot and killed. Ambulances were destroyed. All these reports were in European papers. They were in Al Jazeera. They were in a number of reports. In fact, Dar Jamal, who's a reporter over there, interviewed a number of people who were in the city at the time to verify this. In fact, Marjorie Cohen, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and vice president of the National Lawyers Guild, has called this war crimes, that the invasion of Fallujah violated international law and was a war crime. So we don't know about that. We know that several thousand civilians were killed in that invasion. And they had a total blackout, literally, of what happened there.
You know, what's interesting to me, Peter Phillips, is that since the Lancet study came out, I think it was in 2004, with the figure of 100,000 based on the Johns Hopkins study, I have seen periodically when it's been raised, it's been shot down and said that other people have gone in and critiqued it and come up with lower figures. And there's been, I think, sober assessments of it that have been critical of it. And then there's been sort of quasi-hysterical dismissals of Lancet and Johns Hopkins as both just deranged anti-U.S. institutions by people like Christopher Hitchens. But what's interesting is sort of like the Gary Webb thing, the incident you were talking about earlier, because what's striking here that's most important is that Lancet's the only one that's even tried to do this. They launched it. And this is precisely what has been censored compared to Vietnam, where, you know, keeping the death toll of not just U.S. troops, but of enemy combatants and even civilians was something that was taken quite seriously. And by the U.S. government, and now that's just banned. I mean, that truly is censored.
It truly is. I mean, Vietnam had far more open media coverage. Reporters kind of came and went. The rules of engagement for reporters today are written out. If you're an embedded reporter, there's a whole copy of things you can do and you cannot do. And you're literally, your life is dependent upon the protection of the troops that you are with. Not so much from insurgents, but from other U.S. military units, because we've had the highest rate of journalist casualties in Iraq as any recent war. You know, our journalists are dying regularly in Iraq. If they're not embedded, they become victims of U.S. military.
And in fact, that is our story number 7 on the list of the top 25 most censored stories of 2005. Journalists face unprecedented dangers to life and livelihood in Iraq, but also worldwide. Is that right?
Yeah, that's story number 7, and it was from Truth Out. It was an Interpress story. And the Iraq War has become the deadliest combat zone for reporters since the journalists, International Federation of Journalists began keeping track in 1984. So 49 media workers have lost their lives in Iraq. And this is everything from the Palestine Hotel shooting of Jose Cuso and Taras Potsyuk and others that were injured at that time up to right to the current.
Now, who's killing these journalists? I mean, are they coming from both sides? I mean, is it just a matter that war is getting more dangerous and it's a guerrilla war, or is it that there's less respect for journalists?
The reporters in the Baghdad Hotel were fired on by a U.S. Tank. Al Jazeera offices and the Abu Dhabi TV were bombed by U.S. planes, even though they had given clear indications to the U.S. military where they were and not to be, and that they were civilian you know, media groups. There are a number of other reporters, journalists, Olga Rodriguez, president at the Palestine Hotel, stated that soldiers and tanks had been there 36 hours before, knew the reporters were there, and actually had talked to them. So what we're finding is that you've got, you know, 19-year-olds out there with weapons of war, tanks and artillery and guns, and anybody that's out there in the way, they're faced with insurgents who look like civilians. Reporters get in the middle of that, and they're getting killed.
We're talking to Peter Phillips again on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This show is pre-recorded. Don't call in. Peter Phillips is the professor of sociology at Sonoma State University in California. He is also the director of Project Censored, the group that puts together the annual report of the 25 most censored stories in the U.S. news media. And he's the editor of the new book, Censored 2006, Media Democracy in Action, which is the compilation of the top 25 censored stories of 2005. And it is published by Seven Stories Press, just come out. And I urge people to pick it up and look at it if you're interested in this topic. The third most censored story in 2005, according to Project Censored, is one I know, Peter, that is extremely near and dear to your heart and really gets right into the bone marrow of a democratic society, distorted election coverage. And this is actually the top story of 2004. I'm getting my years mixed up here. So we had an election that year. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, most of this didn't come out until 2005,
mm-hmm.
but this is the discrepancies between the exit polls and the actual votes in many states around the U.S. In November of 2004. So Bush, you know, officially won the election by 3 million votes. But the exit polls had projected Kerry winning by 5 million. So that's a discrepancy of 8 million votes. Now, exit polls are traditionally pretty accurate. And so when this evidence came forward, the polling group, Edison Media Research and Mitofsky International, they didn't release the data until after the inaugural. Once we got a hold of the data, once Steve Freeman, Josh Middledorf, and Joel Blyphus at In These Times got the data, they wrote this up, it became evident to them that the margin of error statistically was absolutely impossible, that it was in excess of 100,000 to 1 overall, and in some states, millions to 1, that the exit polls could have been so wrong. So it takes us back to the story we'd had the prior year in our 2005 book about the voting machines.
Mm-hmm.
ESS, Diebold, and Sequoia are the principal producers of voting machines in the United States. Their principal investors are Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin, the two biggest defense contractors in the country, which you'd think, okay, fine, maybe it's just that they want to, you know, voting machines is a good thing to invest in. But the security systems in the voting machines were designed by SAIC, Scientific Applications International, out of San Diego. On their board of directors is General Wayne Downing, former head of the National Security Council, Bobby Ray Inman, former director of the CIA, another director of the CIA, Robert Gates, and Admiral William Owens, former chair of Joint Chiefs of Staff. So you have a board of directors running this corporation, which is a major defense contractor. They're in the top 10. In fact, SAIC is the one that's running the Iraqi television stations in Iraq right now. And they're designing the software systems in voting machines that were bought by the big military contractors, and they don't have a paper trail. So the statistics that come forward are only in areas where there's no paper trail. So the error rates are high in from exit polls in areas without a paper trail, and the exit polls are what reflecting how the vote came out where there is a paper trail.
I mean, it's that cut and dried.
It's pretty cut and dry. There's a few exceptions, but overall that's the statements. And you know, if there was error, then it would be in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there was an exit poll error, originally the Edison Media said, well, you know, we just must have had more Kerry voters talk to us when they came out of the polls. Not true. The data shows that actually there were more Bush people talking.
Now, what states were affected by this? What states have the no paper trail? I assume there's some states more than others that do.
Ohio, of course, Florida, New Mexico. There were a number. Many of the key states, Pennsylvania, around the country that were very close, is where we're seeing the biggest discrepancies.
And by the logic or the evidence here, there's grounds to think that George W. Bush did not win the 2004 election?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. The statistics are just can't be that wrong.
Now, and, this is really interesting because if you walked into a newsroom, I'm willing to bet, and not just a newsroom, I think, and not just a mainstream newsroom, even like a liberal publication, and make this argument, I think you'd be looked at like, you know, you were, you know, some sort of part of a fringe Looney Tune group. I mean,
well, it starts to become like, oh, you think that the elections were fraudulent. Well, the Carter-Baker Commission is coming out with reports now saying, yeah, we had a problem with the election, lines were too long, registration didn't work well in some places, but there's no evidence of overt fraud. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying. So that's the official line. So where they're going to fix it, and now they're saying, yeah, they're going to want to have a paper trail. They know there was a problem, but to go ahead and say that we had a major problem with the last election would undermine the public's confidence in the democratic process.
Now, is there anyone investigating it, taking the statistical evidence that you're talking about that shows the discrepancy between exit polls and precincts where there wasn't a paper trail, and as opposed to precincts where there is a paper trail and there is no discrepancy. Are there any government investigators somewhere who say, I got to follow up on this and find out what explains it, or is it just basically being left now to...
That's being pretty much left alone as part of the... See, the commission, the Carter-Baker Commission, is saying that, you know, they don't see that as a problem. And Steve Freeman's got a book coming out from Seven Stories Press. It's in print right now. We hope to have it out in the next few months or by the first of the year for sure, which will document more extensively all of this. So we're giving – he's – part of the story was in these Times in February of last year. And Greg Palast had written about some of this, continuing problems, particularly in Florida. And so we've kind of put it all together, and Harvey Weisserman and Bob Farikas in Ohio from the freepress.org group there, we put that all together, and we got a major problem with the last election.
We're talking to Peter Phillips today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Peter Phillips is the director of Project Censored and a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University. He's also the editor of the new book, Censored 2006, the top 25 censored stories in the U.S. news media last year. And we're talking about the winners, if that can be used accurately, on the top 25 list. We've just been talking about number three, another year of distorted election coverage. There is every one of these issues deserves an entire show. I mean, I think the most striking thing to me, Peter, about Project Censored has been from the very beginning, and I've been following it since the beginning, to date myself, is just seeing the stories themselves that aren't getting covered at all. It's just a sort of it's a bracing slap in the face, like, whoa, why aren't we getting this stuff covered? Like the stuff we've just been talking about. What explains this? Why, you know, these are clearly stories that merit as much coverage as, you know, Winona Ryder's shoplifting exploits.
Sure, sure. And this was, I think we really kind of stepped across the threshold this year when Molly Ibbins wrote up the top 10 in her column and said that we need to have a media accountability day. And that Project Censored's annual release is exactly that, a statement to the corporate media that, hey, you've missed some serious things. And she goes through the list and says, yep, mm-hmm, we missed that one. Yeah, we didn't cover that very well. But it runs in the Chicago Tribune, the, you know, San Francisco Chronicle. These papers have never had our list in them before. You know, 30 years of Project Censored, New York Times never mentioned us.
You know, having been a judge and having read the list for year after year since the beginning, there are certain types of stories that invariably appear that are not covered well in our news media that are always on the list. One of them deal with the environment or the ecology. I mean, you can always count on a couple. I see number 10 this year is mountaintop removal threatens
right.
ecosystem and economy. But, I mean, I want you to talk about that story because that is a really important story, and I'm interested in that. But I think I also want you to talk about, Peter Phillips, just the general nature of environmental coverage in our news media, because there are always a prominent number of environmental stories that aren't getting covered.
What corporate America does that has negative impacts on the environment, if the public was fully aware of it and wanted to enforce EPA laws, enforce the rules and regulations, or really just challenge. The government really has vested interest in protecting corporate profits. That seems to be one of the primary motivations of the government. So in this particular story, mountaintop removal, I mean, this is about how environmental activists are, you know, Earth First people are actively blockading these mountaintop removal process is a form of coal mining.
Yeah, let me interrupt you because I got to tell you, Peter, I don't know if you've ever been to Urbana, Illinois, but we don't have a lot of mountains around here. So people listening to this show, this is a very abstract issue. What is mountaintop removal?
It's the blowing up of mountains with dynamite to collect the coal underneath. So the mountain peaks are blown off, and then the refuge of that is dumped into the watershed. So it's almost like a flattening of mountain ranges.
Where is this being done?
In Kentucky, Tennessee, 40 miles from Knoxville in the Appalachian Mountains. You know, it used to be they do strip mining. Now they just blow the whole mountain up and to get to the coal seams. And it's noisy. But it's cheaper than hiring a lot of miners. I mean, you just blow off the tops of these mountains and you can get right to it. So, you know, thousands of jobs have been lost because of this new method. And it's approved by the federal government. And it leaves, you know, thousands of miles of streams are destroyed in West Virginia, Mountaintop Renewable, endangers entire communities, massive sediment dams, and nonstop explosions and erosion. This is a complete destruction of the environment.
Now, where did you at Project Censored find coverage of this story?
It was in Earth First magazine.
Earth First.
Yeah.
And this has been going on for a while. This is not a new story.
This has been going on for a while. This is not new.
And okay.
What's new is that, you know, that we're the energy crisis, that we're really planning more coal plants in the U.S. to create electricity. So 93 new coal plants are being planned for construction throughout the U.S. So the price for coal is good. If you can get a cheap way to get it out of the ground, you can make a lot of money.
Now, I see number 14 here is another issue that's almost always appears, and you just talked about it now in this number 10 with the mountaintop removal. Number 14 is corporations win big on tort reform, justice suffers. You know, I've heard about tort reform a little, and the way it's generally presented is it's stopping, like, you know, sleazy lawyers from, you know, jacking up the price of insurance by cleaning out some company for like $300 million because some woman spilled a Coke in her lap. I mean, what's the story here?
What they take those kinds of stories and then justify a complete reforming of taking away of the public's right to sue corporations for injury. Or they put major limits on HMOs, civil rights violation, workplace injuries, to make sure that big corporations can't be sued for amounts. Now the cap is set at $250,000 per lawsuit. So, you know, if your husband took Vioxx and died and had a stroke and you lost income, you know, for 30 years, the maximum you could get would be $250,000.
We're talking to Peter Phillips again on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Before we go back through the list, Project Censored, top 25 stories, the news that didn't make the news last year, that's in the new book, Censored 2006, published by Seven Stories Press and edited by Peter Phillips. You know, I'd like to ask you, you know, if someone reads this book, they go down the list and they see all these incredible stories that aren't getting covered or getting very, very little coverage and certainly not getting in-depth examination. What do they do? I mean, is the point? I mean, is someone just going to read this book and then, you know, go smash their head against the wall and say, I give up and, you know, maybe I should just, you know, watch wrestling all day long? I know that's not your goal, obviously. What is your vision of how this fits into the Democratic project?
Well, Censored 2006, the subtitle is Media Democracy in Action. So we spend a good bit of time talking about various media activist groups around the country. The students were at the Media Reform Conference that you helped organize this year and described that extensively. And then we take a look at various activist groups that are engaging in media reform at a grassroots level. So finding independent news sources, finding new radio stations and sources of news that are non-corporate, that are outside of MSNBC, CNN, and Fox, and having an awareness of the depth of these stories, finding groups to which are concerned about it, whether it's election fraud or environmental issues or engaging in social justice in whatever way, helps build a democratic process in America.
Peter Phillips, if someone said to you, Peter Phillips, you know, I work a job, I've got kids, I've got to clean my house, you know, I'm really a busy person. I'm really interested to find out what's going on in the world, and I'm depressed that my conventional news media is missing a lot of stories. I've only got 15, 20 minutes a day at most to really put into journalism and news. What should I be looking at? What sort of diet would you recommend?
Well, we get about 200 different publications. My favorite, and I think one of the best national news shows, is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And the Pacifica News, if you can get a hold of a Pacifica station, they're great for radio. I would absolutely stay away from television news because it's really a waste of time. So, you know, unless you're just really worried about what's happening in Katrina in Florida right now or something like that, most of the television news is entertainment-oriented design, and it's very incomplete. So freeing up time by not watching corporate media news gives you time to look for other news and take care of your kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you got 15 or 20 minutes. Okay, you squeeze some of Amy Goodman in. Any print media you would look to or any websites?
There's lots, and we have a directory on our website with over 1,000 independent news sources. I weekly read The Nation. I like In These Times. Mother Jones, the great magazine. Z's pretty good. We even read The New Republic. So there's lots of good independent sources of news. I think for just a quick website check, Common Dreams is very good. Truth Out is marvelous, and Buzzflash is great.
You know, there's sort of a cognitive dissonance, Peter Phillips, that seems to be going on with journalism, in the sense that, you know, the mainstream journalism that you chronicle and that sort of censors these stories exist, yet there's been this emergence on the web of these websites and blogs that are covering, breaking a lot of these stories and talking about these issues, and with extraordinarily limited resources, doing the best you can to cover it. And most of these stories require resources to do justice to, which is the tragedy here. But they don't show up in the mainstream media. So they're like parallel universes, one rich, the other poor.
That's, in many ways, that seems to be what it is. And, you know, if you're online, you have a computer, you can access a lot of information. You can go all over the world and read news. You can read BBC and get their headlines. And if you're not, and you've got a full-time job and you work a swing shift in the evening to help make ends meet and you've got three kids, it becomes extremely difficult. And finding whatever issues concern you the most and becoming aware of those issues and finding one or two sources of independent news, I think is vital for a democratic awareness in our society, and certainly we encourage people to do that.
Peter Phillips, director of Project Censored, editor of Censored 2006. Another type of story that always shows up on the Project Censored list year after year deals with public health issues. AIDS is always, and not just AIDS, and I've got a strong feeling there will be something about influenza on next year's list.
We're actually looking at that right now.
Yeah. You know, these are the sort of stories that don't fare well in our news media, as a rule, at least according to Project Censored. Why is that? And then, if you don't mind, talk a little bit about what you're looking at with the influenza right now.
I think a general theme is all of these stories are about powerful people in both public and private bureaucracies, government and corporations, that are making decisions about our lives for which we have very little awareness of, or that the decisions will have detrimental impacts on millions of people. And those are the kinds of stories that the powerful really don't want exposed. So they will go out of their way to spin a different angle on it or to try to keep it from being covered or just show the positive side of it. The avian flu issue, which Robert Kennedy Jr. wrote about 2 months ago, has gotten some press recently. And it's, you know, they're not sure. They're really saying that this flu is going to make the jump from birds, be brought here, and become epidemic.
Let me back you up for a second, Peter, because we might have some listeners not familiar with much about the story. If you could just give a little more background for people unfamiliar with it.
Birds have been dying in the East, in China and Vietnam, ducks, chickens, from a flu virus. And human beings have had some contact and been dying as well. The virus doesn't usually kills the host before it can migrate, come with, say, Canadian geese all the way down into the U.S. They believe now that the bird dying has fallen off, but the virus is still present in the bird flock so that it's coming into the country and mutating. So if it mutates to a point where humans can pass it to each other, a flu virus, we could be back to 1918 and have a major flu epidemic in the country that could kill 40 million people.
And now, a healthy press system, how in your view would a story like this be covered?
I think we've seen some coverage on it, and most of it has been not, we need to worry about it, but don't worry too much. We really don't know enough yet about the dangers of this. And that's probably, I mean, that we're researching it further. We've got some doctors that have been reading what literature they've got on it, and I'm not sure how that's going to evolve. I mean, it could be a false alarm, or it could be something very serious that public health needs to be engaged in protecting us from.
Let me put it another way, because I know it's tough because it hasn't happened, and so we're speculating. But I think there's a broader issue of public health here, and sort of the role of journalism in alerting people to problems so they don't. There's less damage and people are aware of their options and keep government accountable to do their job. Take a look at Hurricane Katrina. This is too recent to make the news for this year's book, Project Censored's book. But what was your assessment of how the journalism was covering the hurricane, and not simply after it hit, but in the month or two preceding the hurricane, during hurricane season when it was speculated it might happen?
Well, we're going back years now with issues around global warming, saying that more intense hurricanes, more intense storms would evolve because of global warming. It doesn't make hurricanes happen, but it allows them to increase in intensity. So we had this story 3 years ago in terms of superstorms and how the UN had come up with a report predicting these kinds of storms, and they're coming true. So corporate media pretty much stayed away from that back then. And now we're seeing coming forward is, this certainly is being impacted by global warming, that it's increasing the intensity of the storms, and we've had two very terrible storms that have hit the U.S. And we're likely to see a continuation of those of greater magnitude and more deaths. What's interesting about Katrina is that, you know, a year ago, Cuba was hit by a level 5 hurricane, and nobody died. They completely evacuated the areas, including all the people, all the animals. They had doctors and shelters and places for everybody. So they were well organized, dealt with it completely, and they had no casualties. And they had a level 5 hurricane hit them head on, right? Boom, right into them.
Now, that I've heard that too, and I've actually tried to find documentation in the news media. I've Googled it a couple times. And what's been striking to me is that episode is virtually uncovered in our news media. That might be on your list next year, I suspect.
It could be on our list. We're publishing our local independent paper here.
Because it is to me quite interesting that a much poorer country is able to handle a Category 5 so effectively compared to us.
Yes.
Peter Phillips is our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've only got just a few seconds left. And Peter, before we close up, tell us, if you would, how many people are working on Project Censored right now, getting ready for next year's list?
Well, I've got a class of 30 that are researching individual stories. They do one a month, so they'll research about 100 stories this semester. And then we've got 50 interns doing various things, including making television, radio shows, and a variety of other things, but then there's a core group of researchers of about a dozen.
And if people want to stay on top of this, what's the website?
It's www.projectcensored.org.
Projectcensored.org.
And we have regular postings of stories we think are important that people should know about ongoing. So the list is annual, but the website is posting stories every few weeks.
Peter Phillips, professor at Sonoma State University, director of Project Censored, and editor of the new book, Censored 2006, The Top 25 Censored Stories. Thank you so much for joining us in Media Matters today.
Thank you very much, Bob.
I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host. I want to thank Andrea Boyle, my producer. I'll be back in 167 hours at the live show. Thank you for joining us. See you then.
We'd like to say thanks to the 1,225 friends who helped WILL raise over $125,000 during last week's pledge drive. And welcome to the 204 new friends who came on board during the drive. Your support helps us sustain the programs and services you've come to expect and enjoy. Thank you. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with scattered showers, the high in the lower 50s with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy with showers likely, the low in the upper 30s with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, the high in the upper 40s with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.